speak with Jacob Mundy, Associate Professor of Peace and Conflict Studies and Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at Colgate University, about Morocco's recent military operation in a United Nations-patrolled Western Sahara buffer zone and the decades-long dispute between Morocco and the pro-independence Polisario Front. Stay with us. After nearly a century of a Spanish colonial occupation, in 1975, Western Sahara was invaded by neighboring Morocco, resulting in 45 years of war and stalemate to this day. 2 weeks ago, this unresolved conflict was reignited, and it was threatened to escalate into full-fledged war. To understand what is at stake in that part of North Africa, Khalil Bendib spoke with Professor Jacob Mundy of Colgate University and the author of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution.
Jacob, the recent violence in Western Sahara marks a collapse of a 29-year ceasefire in this disputed territory. This war started back in 1975 when Spain vacated its former colony, South Sahara, and Morocco promptly invaded the country or territory, depending on your narrative, you know, whether you're on the side of Moroccan nationalists or on the other side. So Morocco promptly invaded that territory, encountering fierce resistance from independence-minded Sahrawis, as the citizens of that country are known. Before giving us a brief history of this conflict, which continues 45 years later, would you please give us a snapshot of this country and its people? Where is it located exactly? Who are these people, the Sahrawis? What is their claim to nationhood? And how are they distinct from Moroccans and Mauritanians?
Yeah, well, as I said, it's great to be with you, and that's a good question to start off with. The territory of Western Sahara was gradually formed through a series of agreements, mainly between France and Spain, following the what we call the scramble for Africa after 1885. Spain was mainly interested in the region, not for any intrinsic factors that had to do with Western Sahara, but largely because if you look at it on a map, it's pretty much directly across from the Canary Islands on the almost, you could say, the westernmost tip of North Africa.
So the Canary Islands are part of Spain.
Yeah, the Canary Islands were, the indigenous inhabitants were actually annihilated during the Spanish conquest of the Canary Islands. So the Berber peoples who lived there were wiped out, and the Canary Islands became an important staging point for the conquest of the Americas, even with the first initial voyages of Columbus. So the Canaries for a long time have been kind of a strategic asset of the Spanish Empire, though there were sort of vague notions that Spain had possessions along the Saharan coast that were being historically revived in the late 1800s. Really, it was just more this geopolitical context of, you know, everyone grabbing territory in North Africa amidst the decline, especially of the Ottoman Empire. It's not that the Ottomans, you know, power extended that far, but that was part of this competition between the European imperial powers to get as much as they could. And Spain, as a declining power, felt that they had to at least grab something that was of strategic use to them. The people of the region were primarily, in terms of their political economy, nomadic in terms of how they were socially, politically, and economically organized. There were some variations with some tribes who were more involved in fishing, but the general picture we get is nomadic camel herding people. At the same time, it's interesting, if you look at the 1975 opinion of the International Court of Justice, which Morocco actually requested, on whether or not Morocco had any historical title to Western Sahara, the court initially came to the opinion that Western Sahara was not terra nullius, or that is no man's land, right? Because that was one of the issues put to the court, was whether or not Western Sahara belonged to anyone in 1885. When Spain arrived. And one of the interesting but forgotten aspects of that opinion of the court is that The Hague ruled, or at least their opinion, not that it was an enforceable ruling, but the opinion was that the people of Western Sahara were organized in such a way as that they could politically represent themselves, including to external powers, which they did, through their indigenous governmental bodies. And so the court ruled that the Western Sahara actually belonged to the Western Saharans in 1885. Now, ethnically, Western Saharans are very similar to Mauritanians, particularly in terms of the use of the Hassaniya language, as well as kinship structures and cultural traditions. You'll easily find Sahrawi families who have, you know, relatives in southern Morocco, western Algeria, western Sahara, and Mauritania. It's not unheard of. And so if one was looking to culturally situate the Western Saharans, they're part of the primarily nomadic milieu of Arabized Berbers who inhabit the westernmost edge of the Sahara Desert.
And Hassanian is a dialect of Arabic? What is exactly Hassanian?
Yeah, Hassaniya is a primarily spoken dialect of Arabic that is thought to be influenced by the what's often called the Halali invasions of what would be for European periods would be the medieval ages, but was at the height of the power of Islamic empires in the Middle East. So there was a wave of Yemeni and other sorts of groups that were sent into North Africa, and some began to infuse themselves along the coastal parts of the Mediterranean, but some took to the westernmost part of the Saharan Desert. And so a few centuries ago, the cultural transformation of, you know, what are often referred to as the Moors, but really what were at the time the Berbers of the westernmost Saharan Desert, began to re-identify as Arabic-speaking peoples and adopting the Arabic language and even adopting, you know, kinship structures, especially ones that could be traced back to the Middle East, the Arabian Peninsula.
So pretty much like the rest of North Africa, or at least northwestern Africa, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and part of Libya, mostly Berber people who speak Arabic, and some of them identify as Arabs. In terms of religion, are they also Sunni Muslims? What type of religion do they have?
Yeah, mainly Sunni Muslims, majority. The differences would be in the way that nomadic populations of the Sahara tend to practice religion, and that it tends to be less of communal practice on a day-to-day basis, except when dealing with the larger festivals, the end of Ramadan, the Eid Kabir, as it's often called in North Africa.
Yes.
So what you often get is that, you know, Sahrawis will pray more just, you know, and this comes out of nomadic tradition, right, is you pray where you are. And so you don't need a mosque to have that interface with God. And so that's something you also find, of course, with Tuaregs, as well as interesting other features that are similar to Tuaregs, which is that women hold a much more powerful role in society. So Hassaniya cultures and Mauritania and Western Sahara also have traditions of women being much more equal within society.
And the population in 1975 versus today of that territory or country, roughly?
Yeah, the Spanish were determined to hold a referendum on independence. This was announced in 1974. It was a very late decolonization process, considering, you know, all of the other countries were independent either by 1956 or 1960 or 62 for Algeria. Spain was determined to hold on to the territory because of the phosphates, which I'm sure we can talk about later. But the first step was conducting a census. And at the time, they arrived at a figure of 74,000 approximately within the territory of Western Sahara. So it's, you know, given the environment, it's not surprising that the population would be so small.
It was under Spanish colonialism for roughly 90 years. Were they part of the Moroccan Empire, or the Moroccan territory before that? And what, if any, has been the legacy of Spanish rule in the Western Sahara?
Yeah, the The claim that Morocco placed upon Western Sahara was a part of a bigger claim that shortly before independence, the Moroccan Istiqlal or Independence Party began pushing an idea that pre-colonial Morocco was much larger than the territory that was about to be inherited once the French and Spanish protectorates in North and Southern Morocco were terminated. So this idea of Greater Morocco saw the country as encompassing parts of Western Algeria, all of Western Sahara, all of Mauritania, and even parts of Mali. And these were, of course, based upon, you know, very old notions of what Moroccan sultans had been up to, as well as the, you know, even going back to the Almoravid Empire and things of that. So it was a very ambitious sort of agenda that Morocco tried to pursue after independence in several ways. There was even preparations to invade Mauritania before that country was granted independence in 1960 with the rest of French West Africa. But Morocco realized it was too logistically impossible with Spanish Sahara sort of in the way. The next move, of course, was the Sand War in 1963 between a recently independent Algeria and Morocco, where King Hassan made a move on Tindouf, the westernmost Algerian city in the desert. Then once that was resolved through the mediation of the Organization of African Unity, really all that was left was Spanish Sahara in terms of this broader Moroccan claim of a greater Morocco. Once Morocco finally accepted Mauritania's status as an independent sovereign nation state in 1969. And so Spain, which came under increasing pressure from the United Nations, especially the General Assembly, not only to decolonize Western Sahara, you know, to give it an act of self-determination, but increasingly in the early 1970s, the UN resolution said Western Sahara has a right to independence. And in the majority of cases, for most countries around the world that were decolonized, you know, just the granting of independence was enough to satisfy the right of self-determination. Once Spain signaled in 1974 that they were going to do this, to hold a referendum, Morocco with Mauritania, and Mauritania had raised a counterclaim to Spanish Sahara, also citing historical relations between the two countries. They presented a request to the General Assembly for binding arbitration between Spain and Morocco and Mauritania. Spain, of course, would not commit to this, but there was a referral to the International Court of Justice on Moroccan and Mauritanian historical claims to the territory. Now, earlier I mentioned that the court had already determined that Western Sahara belonged to the Sahrawis in 1885, when the Spanish colony was first really kind of formalized. The other aspects of the International Court of Justice opinion are quite interesting if you read them in detail. One, they just, you know, dismiss Mauritania's claim as being quite fanciful, you know, insofar as, you know, Mauritania itself was a coherent state prior to its colonization by France. But then regarding Morocco's claims, looking at the historical evidence, what's really interesting here is that the court adopted the Moroccan notion of what constituted sovereignty. And this idea that even if Morocco did not exert direct sovereignty over a territory throughout history, that the people nonetheless recognize the spiritual authority of the Moroccan king as the commander of the faithful, and therefore that constituted sovereignty. And the court actually took this very seriously and said, okay, that's your definition of sovereignty, show us the evidence. And then the court was presented evidence of, you know, this idea of time and immemorial possession dating back centuries, and they dismissed it as none of this amounts to any evidence that there was ties of sovereignty between Western Sahara and Morocco. And so Morocco was left to present evidence that other countries recognized Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. And here's a really interesting instance where, and we see this again and again, where Moroccan diplomacy seems to shoot itself in the foot over and over on the issue of Western Sahara, is that they presented evidence that actually showed the exact opposite. So for example, there was a lot of these things were shipwreck treaties, that if a ship crashed along the coast of West Africa, various European powers tried to make arrangements so that the sailors or the cargo could be returned. And in several cases, the evidence actually explicitly pointed out that the Moroccan sovereign said, I have no control over these people in Western Sahara. You know, good luck. So reading the court's opinion is actually, because a lot of people just read the summary, and the summary has a kind of caveat that there were ties of allegiance between some tribes that had historical territory in both southern Morocco and Western Sahara. And that's the kind of wedge that Morocco used to justify its invasion of the territory in 1975. But again, that's mainly a grouping of tribes that exist along the border region. And that's also a semi-Berberized tribe, several that are more what we'd associate with the milieu of southern Morocco, which is Tashahite-speaking Berbers of the Anti-Atlas.
We're all familiar with what a typical European colony looks like and does and accomplishes in their colonies. What is the legacy of Spain for 90 years? What they have to claim to have done, if anything, before leaving? They were not a settlement. It doesn't sound like they were settler colonialists, but what did they accomplish, if anything?
Well, it was a very lackadaisical colonialism because, again, there was nothing intrinsic initially that the Spanish were interested in Western Sahara. So there was no need for a civilizing mission or an intensive pacification campaign because there was no significant presence of Spain in the territory itself. It was more of a maneuver to protect Spanish fishing waters and territorial interests in the Canary Islands from French encroachment. And so it was really only with French pressure in the 1930s that Spain finally began to try to push into the interior of the territory, because France's positions in Mauritania and Algeria were being harassed by nomadic guerrillas and raiders who would seek safe haven in the largely ungoverned Spanish Sahara. But it was really after World War II where you begin to see Spain change its mind about the value of the territory, and that comes along with the discovery of the phosphate deposits in Western Sahara, which are very high quality that Spain immediately seized upon and began developing, including building some very large-scale infrastructure, including the world's longest conveyor belt at the time. And so one of the first maneuvers that Spain did was to declare that Spanish Sahara was a province of Spain. It was an overseas province like the Canary Islands. This was an effort to say, you know, much like France argued with Algeria, that, well, this isn't an issue of decolonization because it's a part of our sovereign territory. And the United Nations didn't take that, continued to push for the territory's self-determination and independence. But yeah, there was no significant settlement population of Spaniards in Western Sahara. The few that were there were colonial administrators, security, and things of that sort, maybe some business interests in either the phosphates or the fisheries. Even by 1975, when the crisis emerges between Morocco and Spain, the Spanish presence is not of any kind of significance.
So tell us more about that crisis between Spain and Morocco.
Well, so the once Spain announces that it's going to hold a referendum on independence in 1974, Moroccan diplomacy kind of goes into overdrive. There had previously been an understanding between the dictator in Spain, Franco, and King Hassan II in Morocco that kind of tried to ease tensions, because a complicating factor is that Spain has several presidios, as they're called, in northern Morocco. Two of them are very developed cities, Ceuta and Melilla. And so there was constantly tension between Morocco and Spain on these issues, and there had been a kind of quieting of it. But once a referendum on independence was announced, Morocco had to figure out a way of dealing with this. At the time, the Moroccan monarchy was also facing serious challenges as the economy was faltering, and the military had repeatedly tried to kill Hassan II. He nearly escaped several coups that we know about. There are rumors of other coups that we don't, coup attempts. And so the Moroccan monarchy was really looking for something that could galvanize the nation and perhaps even distract the military in some way. With the issue pending at the International Court of Justice, Spain not only conducted the census that we talked about earlier, but began working with the independence movement, Polisario, which had been formed in 1973 to evict the Spanish colonial presence and achieve national independence. Spain began working behind the scenes with Polisario, developing contacts with them. And even ahead of the release of the ICJ opinion, Spain said that it was prepared to just grant Western Sahara independence, that even a vote on self-determination, even one that might include the option of quote-unquote reunification with Morocco, wasn't necessary, and that Spain was clearly trying to find a way to create a kind of neocolonial arrangement that could ensure continuity of their interests, including economic interests in the phosphates. Once the ICJ's opinion was released in mid-October 1975, Morocco sprung into action, even though the opinion had been a legal defeat of unprecedented proportions. The opinion is still cited in cases like the Israeli wall in Palestinian territory and things like that. It's still a very important opinion in international law. But Morocco sprung into action and announced that it was going to march 350,000 Moroccan civilians into the Spanish-held territory of Western Sahara. And if Spain didn't withdraw its forces, or if Spain attempted to stop the marchers, then Moroccan forces would invade the territory. And it was already known that Morocco was amassing its military forces in southern Morocco in preparation for what may come. The CIA warned Henry Kissinger in some documents that I had decolonized in early October that they were pretty much convinced that Hassan was going to invade Western Sahara regardless of what the International Court of Justice said. And so everything was sort of set into motion in mid-October. And as luck would have it, or as Baraka would have it, if you're
Baraka.
Moroccan.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. That. So Franco goes into a coma the next day after the Green March is announced. And this sends the entire Spanish cabinet into disarray. And there's various factions. And there's you know, those who think that they have a duty to the Sahrawis to guarantee their independence. There are those that want to cut a deal with Morocco. And behind all this is United States and France, which are engineering things at the UN Security Council to make sure that there's no forceful response from the international community, which is quite surprising if you think about it. You have a country that is threatening military invasion to prevent an act of self-determination against a Western European nation state. And the Security Council response is to send the Secretary General on, you know, rounds of sort of useless shuttle negotiations. The Security Council did respond eventually once the Green March began to cross symbolically into Spanish Sahara, calling for the withdrawal of the marchers and things like that. But by then, a deal had already been cut with the Spaniards. The, you know, Morocco would get a face-saving symbolic march into the territory. A few thousand would cross the border and cross back very quickly. And then negotiations would follow 2 weeks later, where Mauritania, Morocco, and Spain would divvy up the territory and Spain would finalize its plans to withdraw. But I think the important thing, and one that more or less firmly establishes that when we talk about Western Sahara, we are talking about an occupation, is that Morocco's invasion began before they had reached an agreement, a formal agreement with Spain. And Spain had no intention of leaving the territory until it was pressured to do so. Or at least it had no intention of leaving the territory on any of their terms, but, you know, allowing for self-determination until pressured to do so by Morocco. And so the narrative you often see in the media is that Spain left and Morocco rolled in. And that's not what happened at all, that, you know, Spain was there and they were forced out by the Moroccans. And the United States, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was the representative at the UN or Washington, boasted about the fact that in Western Sahara and East Timor, he had made sure that the Security Council was utterly ineffective in terms of opposing these two acts of aggression.
That is Professor Jacob Mundy speaking with Khalil Bendib about Morocco's recent military operation in Western Sahara and the decades-long dispute between Morocco and the pro-independence Polisario Front. We'll hear more after a break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Explains the United States and France's bias in favor of Morocco?
Well, I think for France, it's about maintaining a grip on former colonial possessions, particularly the ones that are the most neo-colonial in nature. And we see that over the years, this relationship between France and the Moroccan monarchy has only grown in strength. And so given the crisis within the Moroccan monarchy in the early 1970s and the crisis of legitimacy, the fact that there were popular movements on both the left as well as emerging Islamist movements on campuses that were openly challenging the Moroccan monarchy. I mean, I think it's often forgotten that some of the largest, you know, quote unquote, bread riots of the 70s and 80s occurred in Morocco, including massacres of hundreds in Casablanca.
Yes.
But that the Western Sahara, though it eventually became a kind of albatross around King Hassan II's neck, the fact that he recovered it did go some length to kind of shoring up the regime. And I think for France, it was important that that would happen. The creation of a, you know, military republic in Morocco would have been, you know, a huge loss for French interests in the region, and who knows what that would have done in terms of relationships with Algeria. For the United States, I think it was a similar sort of thing, but it was also a part of, at the time, at least for Henry Kissinger, who later said, you know, what happened in Western Sahara restored the balance between Morocco and Algeria. And this was based on concerns that because of Algeria's growing oil wealth and influence within the wider Arab world and online movement, that, you know, Morocco was looking like quite a reactionary figure, whereas Algeria was the bastion of progressive change in the world and the new economic order and things of that sort. And with the oil money, Algeria had increased significantly the size of its military. And there were concerns within the U.S. government that were Morocco and Algeria to go to war over Western Sahara in 1975 or 1976, that Algeria's air force would just clobber Morocco. But when we think about what Kissinger was doing in the wake of Vietnam globally, right, this idea of offshore balancing or creating kind of productive tensions within regions so that no hegemonic power could emerge within any sphere, and therefore the U.S. could play upon these tensions to keep the world off balance and therefore working within the U.S. interests, that this factored into it. And so we have memorandums of conversations, you know, where Kissinger basically says, well, our best hope is that the UN can achieve a West Papua type thing in Western Sahara, where they, you know, rig a referendum and the territory basically goes to Morocco, as what happened in West Papua with Indonesia. And so since then, the French relationship has been held more or less steady. The United States was initially, you know, viewing the conflict in Western Sahara often through a kind of Cold War lens. The Polisario independence movement was never supported by the Soviet Union in almost any way. That, you know, the major support was always from Algeria in terms of material military support, and then political and diplomatic and moral support, mainly within the non-aligned movement. And that once the Cold War ended, you did see a kind of push for peace in Western Sahara, and that gets to the ceasefire that we're talking about that's been broken recently. But so once the Cold War framing is gone, there's a kind of, you know, what does Morocco really mean to the United States? And, you know, in the 90s, it's a liberalizing ally. And then in the 2000s, it's a partner in the war against terror. And, you know, now more recently, there's all these rumors about whether Morocco will be the next Arab country to recognize Israel.
Which Morocco was a pioneer in this sort of thing in the early 60s, when they basically sold their nationals who happened to be Jewish to the state of Israel. So Morocco, as you were saying earlier, has always been a very good, loyal ally, and some might say a vassal of France and the U.S. in many ways, in many different instances, on many different instances. So tell us about Algeria's reaction to that crisis. Why were they supporting the Polisario? I mean, there are some obvious, you know, I happened to be Algerian. I was there at the time. And behind the legitimate rhetoric of, you know, being in favor of people's right to self-determination in Sahara, in Western Sahara, there were other motivations that Algerians were not specifically, explicitly voicing, but that were also very important motivations.
Certainly. I think, you know, self-determination and the right of colonized peoples to independence is really baked into political DNA of Algerians. And I don't just think that that's a elite rhetoric. I do think that that's, you know, down to the grassroots level.
Yes.
And I think, you know, we kind of saw that thrown back at the regime in terms of, I think, the Harak movement in some ways. But in 1975, only in the summer of 1975, did Algeria under Boumediene begin to warm up to the Polisario. That Polisario did not initially receive a lot of support from Algeria, but they had to go to other places, including to Gaddafi, to get arms and support and things of that sort. And Gaddafi's influence even shows in some of the ways in which Polisario organized its state in exile and things like that. But for the Algerians, supporting Polisario initially in the likelihood that it was going to, the territory was going to be granted independence by Spain made sense. But then what happened in October and November 1975, from the Algerian perspective, was that North Atlantic powers conspired behind Algeria's back to redraw the map of North Africa without their consent. And this is sort of, I think, really one of the secret motivations that infuriated Boumediene. I mean, we know at the time that Bouteflika was kind of trying to play a game with the Western Sahara issue.
And he was the foreign minister at that time.
Yes, yeah. Later president, but foreign minister. That he was trying to get ratification of the border, which had been contested by Morocco, and most notably in the wake of that 1963 Sand War. But really, Algerian policy just snaps into this unified position once it becomes apparent that Spain is going to back down, give the territory to Morocco and Mauritania, and Algeria hasn't been consulted about this to any extent. The U.S. ambassador, Richard Parker, you know, later felt a lot of regret because he had been assuring the Algerians of one thing and not knowing that behind the scenes, Kissinger and other figures were trying to engineer this outcome that was against Algeria's, what they viewed as their strategic interests and things of that sort. That, you know, there's a small bit of border between Western Sahara and Algeria, but that's enough to say that Algeria should be consulted. And that's to a certain degree why Algeria is also an indirect participant in the negotiations over Western Sahara at the UN since 1987. So there's that. And I think there's a strategic element to it. But often I think observers overstate this notion that Algeria just supports Polisario because it is a rock in the shoe of Morocco, kind of thorn in the side of King Hassan and now Mohammed VI, this sort of that they can, you know, use it as a screw to turn pressure or to justify the continued closing of borders, things of that sort. But I think Algeria sees in Polisario a reflection of itself in the FLN days, when during the War of Independence. And I think I guess, these are principles that really matter to Algeria. I mean, only recently, you know, as Algeria decided that it might actually think about sending troops abroad on peacekeeping missions. But, you know, the idea of non-intervention, especially by European forces, is an important principle for Algerians. And so to see the Western Sahara just divided at the hands of France and the United States and the Security Council was just, I think, too much. And Boumediene, you know, later bragged that they were going to bleed Hassan white, you know, that there was going to be revenge for what had happened. So, yeah, when we think about other motivations, I think those are first and foremost.
Yeah, to be more specific, what I had heard at the time in Algeria was that Algerians were, among other motivations, among other plays that they were making, were using this issue, the Polisario issue, as a way to force Morocco to give up its claim to Tindouf, which had been the object of contention right after Algeria's independence, when Algeria became independent after a very bloody war against the French. Algerians just felt they naturally inherited the territory delineated by France as Algeria, which included Tindouf. Unfortunately, the Moroccans disagreed with that. The Moroccans, instead of fighting for their independence as the Algerians had, except for places like the Reef in northern Morocco, had patiently waited for the French to leave to attack Algeria for that part of what they felt was should be part of Morocco. That conflict not having been resolved by 1975, some in Algeria felt that, well, the least that Morocco could do if they wanted peace or lack of interference from Algeria in the Western Sahara would be to declare that, yes, we do recognize Algeria's sovereignty on that part of Algeria that we felt should be part of Morocco.
Yeah, and I think there was that mixing of agendas in the early 70s, again, with Bouteflika as foreign minister. And that's initially why I think Algeria was hesitant to support Polisario, as well as there was also issues with Spain. Algeria had hosted the Canary Islands Independence Group and things like, and various other groups that opposed Spanish colonialism. But again, that was maybe about getting certain concessions. That all shifted again with this crisis in October and November 1975. And there were already early indications of this, that, you know, Morocco had, for some reason, come to the conclusion, and this is still, I think, up to some historical debate, that Algeria was more or less willing to acquiesce to a Moroccan takeover of Spanish Sahara by early 1975. But when the International Court of Justice held its hearings in the summer, Algeria was, you know, given space to make arguments, and they made some of the most forceful arguments for self-determination in front of the court, which came as a bit of a shock to the Moroccans.
So tell us briefly the history since 1975. I know it's a lot to cover very briefly, but the referendum that was agreed to that never really took place, this distinction between notions of independence versus autonomy, and where we are today.
Yeah, so the again, Polisario was already active as independence, as an armed insurgency group against the Spanish, and had gained some skills in that arena, not to mention the fact that they had indigenous knowledge of the territory. And so when Morocco gains the territory in 1975, they're dealing with a guerrilla fighting group that is outsmarting them and outfighting them at almost every instance, that despite the fact that the initial Moroccan invasion, which included bombing civilian areas with napalm, had created this humanitarian catastrophe where we get the refugee camps in Tindouf that now house about 40% of the indigenous population of Western Sahara. The latest count is that there's over 170,000 of them in those camps today. That in the early phases of the war, Polisario quickly knocks Mauritania out of the fight and even attacks the Mauritanian capital in one famous episode. When Polisario turns his attention on Morocco, with Mauritania sort of out of the picture, they drive Morocco almost back beyond the anti-Atlas. You know, Polisario is conducting raids and things of that sort in southern Morocco. And this is what begins to freak out Morocco's supporters. This is Saudi Arabia, who's interested in, you know, maintaining monarchies across the Middle East, France and the United States. France even on occasion uses direct military intervention, flying jets out of Senegal to bomb Polisario when they're attacking Mauritania. And the United States begins increasing its arms, which are financed by Saudi Arabia to the tune of $1 billion a year between 1979 and 1981. And this support and financing, as well as the kind of Reagan administration taking, you know, any constraints off support for Morocco, really helped Morocco turn the tide. And the way that Morocco turned the tide was the construction of what ultimately became 2,700-kilometer barrier, you know, dug out of the Saharan desert, stuffed full of landmines, and monitored by bases and radar and sensing equipment, and, you know, at almost, I think, 5-kilometer intervals. So this limited Polisario's freedom of movement. They weren't able to operate as a guerrilla insurgency in the classical sense anymore, that all they could do was attack Morocco's defensive wall, which meant that economic life could return to some kind of normalcy under Moroccan occupation in the major cities, especially the fishing center of Dakhla and the major capital, Laayoune. So there's kind of a stalemate that emerges in the late 80s. You know, Polisario can't mount any sort of ambitious forays into the territory without risking major losses. But Morocco can't knock Polisario out of the fight without invading Mauritania and Algeria. So diplomacy really kind of becomes the only way to settle the issue. Now, the Organization of African Unity, what we now call the African Union, had initially led the peace process, because the United Nations in 1976 looked at the situation and said, well, there's no self-determination. It's still a colony. What can we do? The OAU comes in and says, okay, looking at the situation, this is what should happen. There should be a ceasefire. There should be a referendum. And then, well, the refugees should come back before the vote, ideally. But then there would be a vote on independence or integration with Morocco. And the fact that this would even be considered integration with Morocco was itself a concession on the part of Polisario, given the fact that Western Sahara was understood to be, you know, a sovereign country in 1885, and that if granted independence, that would just be a restoration of that sovereignty. But the other factor that was going on was a lot of countries around the world were beginning to recognize Polisario's government in exile. And this was putting a lot of pressure on Morocco to make some concessions at the Organization of African Unity so as to prevent that organization from recognizing the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, which today is still a full member state within the African Union. Morocco tried to kind of punt and delay and defer, and eventually the OAU recognized Western Sahara as a member state. Morocco left the organization, you know, a boycott that lasted until 2017. With the OAU out of the picture, the UN picks up the ball, but basically adopts the same framework: ceasefire, return the refugees, vote on independence or integration. And surprise, King Hassan II agreed to this. And a lot of people think that he wanted to get the issue settled before passing the throne onto one of his sons. But what happened was a ceasefire was unilaterally declared in 1991 by the UN Secretary General, yet every other aspect of the plan that the UN Security Council had adopted in April of that year was put on hold, and mainly because Morocco had raised a series of questions about who had a right to vote in the territory and who is a Western Saharan or a Sahrawi. So the 1990s became this decade that was consumed with this question of who is a Western Saharan. And they had to personally interview, you know, every voter applicant for the referendum, that there were over 240,000 applicants. Over 180,000 were interviewed in person. And the voter list that was arrived at was only 86,000. So that gives you a sense of the Moroccan effort to try to control the outcome of the vote by presenting, you know, over 100,000 people as Western Saharans who had no historical ties to the territories. It's really hilarious if you talk to people who were involved in the identification process.
So a lot of these were Moroccans.
Who were coached. They would put a traditional Sahrawi robe on them and send them into a UN identification center. And the UN actually opened more identification centers in Morocco than Western Sahara, just to accommodate this absurd request by Morocco. So by the late 90s, the Western Sahara seemed to be heading towards independence, as was East Timor. There was a similar process unfolding there. And the Western Saharan peace process had been given a jumpstart when James Baker was called in to kind of get things back on track in 1997 as a favor to Kofi Annan following the 1991 Gulf War. And so Baker gets things going. They finish the identification process. And then we hit this sort of series of contingencies that really just throw everything up in the air, especially whether or not there will ever be a referendum on independence. And one was King Hassan died in the summer of 1999. And along with it died Morocco's commitment to a referendum on independence, that Hassan Mohammed VI quickly began to be convinced, especially by figures in the Clinton administration, that this was not the way that you want to settle this. And one of the reasons why the Clinton administration had soured referendums, winner-takes-all referendums, is because of what happened in East Timor, where Indonesia had agreed to a referendum on independence. The people, surprise, had voted for independence, and the Indonesian military went berserk, and the Security Council was put in a position of having to act. And so there was a more forceful humanitarian intervention. Clinton was forced to, you know, call up the Indonesian president and say, back off. And that was a position that they didn't want to be put in Western Sahara, especially with a new king in Morocco, an untested king, a young king, someone who wasn't thought to have the kind of nerves of steel and, you know, the brutal instincts of Hassan II. And so the referendum was basically killed in the crib in 1999-2000. When the Security Council said, yeah, we don't really want to do this. And since then, the peace process has been dedicated to this contradictory pursuit of a negotiated political solution that will provide for self-determination. So negotiated means Morocco has to agree to it. Self-determination means it has to provide for an independence option. Morocco rules out the option of independence. So what can actually be done unless Polisario, as the UN-recognized representative of the Sahrawi people, give up the right to self-determination? And that's sort of been the hope of Morocco and some of its allies. And that's kind of some of the impetus behind this idea of autonomy. Now, in 2007, Morocco put forward an autonomy proposal. Morocco had successfully stonewalled Baker's efforts to resolve the issue, and Baker resigned in frustration in 2004. Morocco pulls out this autonomy proposal. And by any international standard, it's not even autonomy. You know, it's at best a kind of devolved regional status. But the sine qua non of autonomy is that your local government can't be abolished by the national government. And the Moroccan monarchy, the Moroccan state, the idea that there would be a local government that the monarchy can't abolish, you know, one that would probably be dominated by Polisario or pro-independence voices, is just really kind of unthinkable within the architecture of the Moroccan state and the Moxim and those sorts of traditions. And so really we've been in this sort of, you know, world of make-believe peacemaking since 2000, where the Security Council thinks that, I think the Security Council thinks that the only agreement that they will accept, one that is sort of self-implementing and self-enforcing, and it's obviously that's never going to happen, but no one's going to put pressure on Morocco. And Polisario increasingly realized this and became increasingly frustrated with the peace process going almost nowhere, that Morocco had stonewalled the work of the previous envoy, Christopher Ross, a U.S. ambassador, had twice tried to declare Ross persona non grata and succeeded the second time. His replacement, former German president, Horst Köhler, was immediately stonewalled by Morocco and resigned, you know, less than a year and a half in office. And since then, it's been a year and a half since we've had any mediation or even a named successor to the lead the peace process in Western Sahara. And I think that's the background to this frustration that the Western Saharan independence movement is feeling when they see Morocco sending truckloads of goods south to Mauritania through what is effectively their territory, according to the UN ceasefire agreement, that they decided to protest this. And Morocco used military force to remove those protesters. And Polisario said, that's a red line, and we're going to go to war. And that's exactly what we got.
Jacob Mundy is assistant professor of peace and conflict studies at Colgate University. He's co-author of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. He spoke with Khalil Bendi. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. The documentary film The Dissident by Oscar-winning director Brian Fogel exposes the labyrinth of deceit behind the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul. On October 2nd, 2018, Khashoggi entered the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul and never came out. The documentary includes the never-before-seen surveillance footage and unprecedented access to a wealth of other damning information previously unavailable to the public. The Dissident will begin playing in select theaters on December 18th. And for more information, please visit thedissident.com. Also on December 18th, the documentary film Nasreen opens in theaters across the country in virtual cinemas. The documentary film Nasreen, directed, produced, and written by Jeff Kaufman, is an immersive portrait of the leading jail human rights lawyer Nasreen Sotoudeh. In the courts and on the streets, Nasreen has long fought for the rights of women, children, religious minorities, journalists, and artists, and those facing the death penalty. In the midst of filming, Nasreen was arrested in June 2018 for representing women who were protesting Iran's mandatory hijab law. She was sentenced to 38 years in prison plus 148 lashes. Nasreen Sotoudeh was released from the prison on November 8th after being granted a temporary leave of absence. According to her husband, Reza Khandan, on November 11th, she tested positive for the coronavirus, and on December 2nd, she received a summons ordering her to return to prison. On December 18th, the documentary film Nasreen opens in theaters across the country in virtual cinemas. To get tickets, please visit nasreenfilm.com. That's NASRINfilm.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends are prohibited, and travel between regions should be avoided. In red zones, it's also forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the specific measures addressing the situation. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Forced to go toe-to-toe, blow for blow in a war zone with only stones to throw. Vilified by all sides, vilified for small crimes. Forced to go blow for blow in a war zone with only stones to throw. Goliath. We're gonna drink. We're gonna drink. We're gonna drink. Hasn't changed, same old monopoly, same couple players on all of the property. I ain't a prop, don't get no props to me, my people still don't eat properly. Think we forgot, we was just property, think we'll be bought again. Think that they brought them democracy, I think they brought back them poppies. These my people locked up and chopping, that's hypocrisy. We wasn't thought of, we wasn't brought up and taught, we was set up, that's why we get caught up. Y'all discarded us, put them bars up, of course we got guards up. We hard cause we hard up, they got them startups and Starbucks. We got a couple of stars so they turn them to starters. They starve us, can't even drink water, up north with that Flint water, all in the sink. They see for the kids on the brink. Y'all went to Harvard and Stanford. Think harder for answers, man. Think we're far below standards. Don't tell me anger won't help us. You told me the cancer would shrink. We need to shrink. We just see boys making bands and sink. Open your eyes, my fam. We all could be gone in a blink. Game hasn't changed, same game of life we play. Maybe I'm only one roll of the dice away from a rose with some ice and some gold on the license plate. We roll a whole life away. I think they gamed us, made us be gamers. They game with the system, they made it to play us. Gave us controllers, we gave no control up. The game wasn't made, so we make it, it's made up. It's war that they're waiting, just look at these wages they pay us. It's pennies, it pays us, they paint us in corners on corners. What can we do, man, we're cornered. I'm lucky I'm stuck in this bull.
booth. Stuck here all cooped up. People get stuck up for loot. Stuck up in bougie. What stuck us in jewelry? They could have stuck up for the youth. Stuck up for justice and truth. Now we can either get loud or just shut up and shoot. Give us a shot. Don't shut us out from the group. You can shut down the nuke. Don't push our buttons and suddenly y'all could go poof. Gone in a blink. Gone in a blink.
The simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The productions Nuit d'Afrique and Tidi Bang Group are proud to present a musical encounter between Africa and First Nations with Mi'kmaq Africa, Jelle Tapa, and Anaknid on the stage of the Nationale and broadcast live on Nuit d'Afrique's Facebook page, Friday, February 26th at 8 p.m. More info at productionsnuitdafrique.com.
Yeah.